A judge says no to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The child-free say yes to dogs and no to kids. A court says maybe on stem cell research. The media say maybe too much on the Quran story. China rethinks its one-child-only policy. And the church faces the new challenge of the cities. This is September 10, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. A federal district judge in California struck down the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. The decision came yesterday as Virginia A. Phillips, a judge of the federal district court in California, struck down the rule. She cited both the Fifth and the First Amendments to the U.S. Constitution in establishing her ruling. She wrote, and I quote, "The Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy infringes the fundamental rights of United States service members in many ways. In order to justify the encroachment on these rights, defendants faced the burden at trial of showing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell Act was necessary to significantly further the government's important interests in military readiness and unit cohesion. Defendants failed to meet that burden." End quote. Now, in other words, this federal district court judge ruled that she, rather than the United States military, is actually in the best position to judge what military readiness requires and what would make for unit cohesion in the United States military. This is a massively important decision. It will be appealed, and it's likely to be stayed in terms of its appeal through the federal appellate courts and perhaps all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it comes, of course, as President Barack Obama has indicated that his administration is going to seek the overthrow of this policy through executive and legislative means. The American people have defended and supported this policy. And through repeated investigations and reviews, the military has stood by the policy, certainly in terms of its current effect, and in light of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. This judge demonstrated once again what audacity and activism look like in the federal courts. She cited the Fifth and the First Amendments. What makes that really interesting is her citing of the First Amendment indicates that the don't tell part was a major concern. And she cited the First Amendment in terms of our fundamental right of free expression and freedom of speech. What she disregarded here is the military's interest in protecting unit cohesion and making sure it can readily deploy a military force. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy didn't come out of a vacuum. It goes back to the earliest weeks of the Clinton administration, when then-President William Clinton indicated that he wanted to fulfill his campaign pledge to go to the full inclusion of homosexuals in the United States military. Neither Congress nor the military was willing to go with that policy, and the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was a compromise that came out of that political context. What we have now is a federal judge representing not only her court, but the tendency of other federal judges at other courts and at other levels of the courts to intervene in these cases and to claim and to cite a constitutional right of persons, regardless of sexual orientation or sexual practice, to be involved in the full deployment of the United States military. Now, what we have here as well is a case of judicial activism where this judge is acting in the place of the military, and we have the troubling illustration once again of the effect of Supreme Court decisions. Back in 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the decision in Lawrence v. Texas. That opinion, the majority opinion, was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy. Justice Kennedy used some of the most expansive language ever found in a Supreme Court decision or opinion when he suggested that one's personal autonomy was at stake in terms of a constitutional right to certain intimate relations and practices. Now, what that opens the door to, and it was seen at the time by colleagues on the court, such as Justice Antonin Scalia, what that opened at the time was a door to the full inclusion of all persons in the military, or frankly, in other sectors of American public life, regardless of sexual orientation or sexual lifestyle. Now, that is a massive issue of importance to the military. But given the centrality of the military in American life, this will have ramifications for the entire culture. We're going to have to watch this very carefully and watch it very closely. This decision handed down by Judge Virginia Phillips of the Federal District Court in California will be reviewed by higher courts. But this is also going to be a matter of current political discussion and of legislative and executive action. Folks, what we're looking at here in terms of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is a policy that has been identified by those pushing for the full normalization of homosexuals as something that simply has to be overcome at whatever cost. And that cost is going to be massive in terms of both the military and the culture at large. A fascinating story appeared in the Weekly Standard. It's written by Jonathan Last and is entitled "There Goes the Neighborhood." Now, the Weekly Standard in this case is going back to an earlier report published in the Washington Post. There in the newspaper in our nation's capital, they ran a story about the breeders versus the child-free. It turns out that there are a significant number of couples and adults in Washington who would prefer to have the parks for their dogs rather than for children. There's something of a baby boom going on in Washington, D.C. There are additional babies in the parks and strollers walking in the public spaces and being pushed along the streets. And what we have in this particular story is a window into the soul of the nation. Now, the child-free are distinguished from the childless. The child-free, well, that represents a movement of those who are saying we don't want children. We're choosing a lifestyle without children. And the insinuation and implication behind this is that people who do choose to have children are merely making a lifestyle choice that they should not impose upon others. That's the argument. But what makes this particular story from Washington of interest is that, once again, what we have are dogs who are being claimed as being more or less equivalent to children. You have people who are claiming that the presence of these babies and toddlers and young children in the Washington parks are displacing the dogs. Now, what makes this particularly noteworthy from a point of cultural analysis are the comments that were published at the Washington Post. Let me just read to you one of them as cited by Jonathan Last in the Weekly Standard. Quote, "I won't make any apologies. I hate kids, especially babies. If parents can't afford or locate a sitter, then stay home." End quote. Now, that kind of language, of course, written on the comment section of a newspaper, is perhaps an illustration of the kind of intemperate mood that we find in certain sectors of the culture. But what's really troubling is that comment is more or less indicative of what appeared in the comment section of the newspaper, and it's also indicative of the kind of argument we're hearing in the culture at large. There are many persons who are seeing parenthood as an imposition, who are seeing babies as indeed something that we would be, well, better off without. Keep the parks for the dogs. Keep your babies at home. Folks, this is a sign of a culture that is really in trouble. When we no longer see babies as divine gifts to be welcomed, when we no longer see children as cultural assets to be cherished, when we see dogs increasingly and pets taking the place of children in the lives of adults who are just deciding not to have children, and when we see those who are having children defined as breeders, we see a real problem at the heart of the soul of a culture. While we're looking at the courts, another major decision was handed down yesterday, this time by a federal appellate court, which on Thursday temporarily lifted a lower court's ban on federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. You may remember that just a couple of weeks ago, in the U.S. District Court in D.C., Judge Royce Lamberth handed down a decision that shocked the nation. It certainly caught the elites by surprise when Judge Lamberth handed down a decision that ruled that the Obama administration's policy on the use of human embryonic stem cells in research violated federal law and the intention of Congress. President Obama, you may remember, announced early in his administration a liberalizing of the rules that had been set down by the Bush administration on the use of federal funding for human embryonic stem cell research. Now, Judge Lamberth's decision landed like a bomb in the world of medical experimentation, and very quickly there were attempts to appeal his ruling. Now, what we see here from this federal appellate court is indeed a stay, a temporary lifting of Judge Lamberth's decision. The story's not over yet. In fact, it's not over by a long shot. But something else is emerging here. Here's the question. The reality is that the most promising avenue for stem cell research in terms of medical application is coming from the use of adult stem cells. These are not morally problematic because there is no destruction of a human embryo involved in the collection of these stem cells. Why are those who are doing research in this area then so intent on pushing for federal funding of research that uses human embryos and requires the destruction of the embryo? The answer is becoming increasingly clear, and I think it comes down to this. They are determined not to allow the sanctity of human life to be a deciding factor. It seems to me, and to many others looking at this case now, that what we have here is a culture, in terms of the elites in the medical experimentation field, who are pushing for the use of human embryonic stem cells, even when other cells will do better. Why? Because they cannot allow the sanctity of human life to be the deciding factor. Because if it is the deciding factor in this case, by implication and extension, it would be in other cases as well. The global media attention to the proposed burning of a Quran by a tiny little church in Gainesville, Florida, has now caught the attention of the media about the media. Brian Stelter, writing in the New York Times, is talking about something several of us have been trying to talk about for the last several days. This story is simply overblown. It's largely a creation of the media. We're talking here about a tiny little church in Gainesville, a church of less than 50 persons in attendance. We're talking about something that shouldn't be a focus of worldwide attention, but all of a sudden became a conflagration. Now, to his credit, Brian Stelter, writing for the New York Times, goes back to look at the story, and what he finds is that this is basically a media invention to a considerable degree. He writes this: Mr. Jones, that is the pastor of this church, was able to put himself at the center of these issues by using the news lull of summer and the demands of a 24-hour news cycle to promote his cause. He said, and this comes as a statistical marker here, he said that he consented to more than 150 interview requests in July and August. Did you note that? July and August. That is before this present month. That means that this story has been building through the media for 2 months. Now, what we have here is a lamentable case of a church that is creating a scandal to the gospel of Jesus Christ by pulling a publicity stunt. But that's exactly what it is. It's a publicity stunt, and the media were complicit in allowing this publicity stunt to get so much attention. I think it's very healthy that in this case you have a media outlet as illustrious as the New York Times asking whether indeed this was largely a creation of the media. It reminds me of a comment made by the late Daniel Boorstin, who was once the Librarian of Congress. Speaking of these big cultural events, he pointed out that many of them are actually pseudo-events. They're not real events. They're just events that look like events. Let's hope that things turn out happily in this case. The church now proposes to put a suspension on its plans to burn the Quran, but this story appears to be turning over minute by minute, and I'm sure we'll be hearing much more about it over the weekend to come. USA Today is reporting a very important development. China is reviewing its one-child-only policy. You will recall that that draconian policy put in place by the dictatorship in China requires couples to have only one child. And what we have in China is the reality of infanticide, abortion, and forced sterilization as this dictatorial regime enforces this policy over against their fear of population growth. Well, now China's reconsidering the policy. USA Today reports in a front-page story and in a major story inside the newspaper that China is having to rethink the policy. Is it because they've now developed moral concerns about infanticide, about over 100 million missing baby girls, over abortion or forced sterilization? No. Their concern is workers. There simply are not enough workers as China looks to the future. The one-child-only policy did indeed put limits on the population, but with the aging of China's population, this means that there simply will not be enough people to work. China is being forced to rethink the policy. Now, in an article that I published today at albertmiller.com entitled Mission and Metropolis, the Church and the City, I'm arguing that the Christian Church has to rethink our neglect of the cities. Foreign Policy Magazine, one of the most influential journals of news and opinion worldwide, has a fascinating cover story entitled Metropolis Now. It informs us that over half of humanity now living lives in cities. And it is a story that includes a good deal of research that ought to capture our attention. Just consider some of these facts that come from McKinsey Global Institute and its prime director, Richard Dobbs. 70% of all Chinese will live in cities of more than 1 million people by the year 2025. By the year 2030, China alone will count at least 220 cities with populations exceeding 1 million. India, by the way, will have at least 68 cities of similar population size. Together, India and China will add over 600 million city dwellers within the next 20 years. That's, by the way, the populations of Brazil and the United States added together. China will have to add at least 40 billion square meters of living space within the next 2 decades just to take care of this expanding urban population. The journal, in this case, gives the example of one city in China that hardly existed just a few decades ago and now counts over 32 million inhabitants. You go from Indonesia to sub-Saharan Africa, and then, of course, to Asia, and you find these burgeoning cities. This is the shape of the future. This is the shape of the global population that we will see in the 21st century. Now, let's remember that Christians have a particular stake in this. The Christian church, just look at the New Testament, was largely an urban church in its first century and more. You're looking at cities such as Ephesus, Corinth, Antioch, not to mention Jerusalem and Rome. You're looking at these cities being the platforms for missions, church planting, and evangelization. You fast forward 16 centuries to the Reformation, again, largely of movement in the cities in Switzerland and in Germany in particular. Then you go to the 19th century, many of the most cherished and influential, formative evangelical ministries we know grew out of cities such as London and Edinburgh and Birmingham, Chicago and New York. But for the 20th century, the city basically became the great engine of secularization, and for the most part of the last several decades, Christianity has been in retreat in at least the major cities of the West. In 1965, when Harvey Cox published his book, The Secular City, the book was controversial, but the title was not. The big issue for Foreign Policy magazine, of course, is how the decision makers of the world respond to this reality. We are at a global inflection point, it says. My question is the church hearing this? Does the church understand this reality? And will we respond to this great missiological challenge? The gospel is at stake. You'll find that article and much more at my website at albertmohler.com. You'll find resources there. You'll also want to follow at Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College and its outstanding programs of undergraduate education, go to Boyce, that's B-O-Y-C-E.edu. I'll meet you next Monday for the briefing.